Please join me in welcoming our main speaker, Dan Kay from Santa Maria.
My very first speaker meeting almost 8 years ago. One thing I know for sure about God's plans for me is I have no idea what they are. He's shown that through experience. The fact that I'm even up here today is beyond anything I would have ever foreseen. It's an honor and privilege to be here. I'm not a circuit speaker. I don't have, you know, 20, 30 years. All I know is an alcoholic trying to stay sober one day at a time. And that's the best I can do. I may not be able to connect with everybody here. You may not relate to my story. I may not be able to keep even 10 people from ever drinking again. But hopefully something I say will inspire one person that maybe can. Or if not, at least be able to keep another person sober and continue the chain that is provided for me. So I'm grateful to be alive and sober is a gross understatement. I cannot verbally paint you a picture of the feeling I have today and what Alcoholics Anonymous has been able to do in my life with the help of a higher power and the help of the men and women of Alcoholics Anonymous. We'll get rolling. Talk briefly about a little bit of the childhood. I'm going to try to move quick and get me sober. turns out I was adopted at the age of 2. I think I found this out when I was around 7 or 8 years old. I kind of really didn't fit correctly with the family. And when I found out I was adopted, I kind of had like some abandonment issues possibly, an identification, identity crisis. They adopted me at the age of 2 and then they got my brother, Don. Hey, oh, by the way, my real name is Danny Ray Kibler Jr. Where Dennis came from is when we used to go to seminary in the Mormon church, they had us on the board that said Dan K and Don K. And they were like, okay, which one's Dan, which one's Don? It kind of just stuck. So if you're wondering, I used to tell the old people when I met him here that I was Norwegian, it was just easier. So anyway, as I was growing up, I had some issues. I used to hold my breath until I passed out if I didn't get my way, and I can physically do that. I tried it recently and I can't, but I was constantly just trying to disconnect. They sent me to therapists, and they would ask me questions about my feelings and emotions, and I never could find the words to explain what I was feeling. I didn't understand my feelings. I didn't understand my behavior. That's what you guys are supposed to do. I shut down. They would ask me questions, and I would answer them, and they'd be like, oh my God, that's not good. Then it would lead to 20 more questions. And so I finally, I just shut down. I didn't want to open up to you. I felt pressured. I felt confused. Moving forward in my childhood, me and my brother, we did manage to run away, I think it was 7 times from the age of 10 to 14. I ran away 7 to 6. I did one more. We used to, well, honestly for me, I used to lie a lot. I used to steal my mother's PTA money, sister's babysitting money, anything I could. Money out of my dad's drawer for rent or a stack of 20s. He's not going to miss a couple. Obviously, I wouldn't do that if I knew how much I could be blamed for it. But, you know, and we got, they didn't have CPS back then. Okay, when we got in trouble, we got in trouble. I've been hit across the back of the legs with rubber hoses, small sections. I've been put on restriction for entire summers in the backyard. I remember one time I got caught stealing and like they shaved my head. I had to go tell my little coach on the thief I can't play baseball anymore. Humiliating, they tried to discipline me, humiliate me. But, you know, consequences weren't a deterrent. You think after that you would stop lying, you would stop stealing, you would stop running away. But what that taught me is I need to improve my skills. I need to figure out how to be a better liar, how to steal better, how to, you know what I'm saying? I grew up really high tolerance for pain. I grew up high tolerance for isolation. Humiliate me, no problem. You know, they can't keep me so long and I'm gone again, so. I did, like I said, I had emotional behaviors. I had issues with feelings, abandonment issues, the whole deal. I moved forward and get me sober quickly. You know, those carried on throughout my life. I remember in Unchained Junction, like 2011, unfortunately I'm not able to leave that. I have to leave out the part about my kids and abandonment and things like that, but if you'd like to talk to me later, feel free. In 2011, well actually in 2005, I'd come back to California. I'd had a couple kids. I owed $98,000 in child support. I hadn't seen him in 15 years. I didn't have a license. My brother helped me get my license. He paid me $10,000 cash. He's a great negotiator. And gave me a place to stay. I was going to have a list in Colorado. I couldn't handle seeing my kids. The emotions were too much. The reality of abandoning them for 13 years, once I saw the guilt, the shame, the remorse, it's almost like waking up from a drunk. You know, you wake up after 5-6 days and you're like, oh my God, look what I did. Well, this was 13 years later and all of a sudden reality hit me. And I continued to drink, I continued to do different things, and I ended up moving into a homeless shelter in Redding, and I was more comfortable there. That's where I come from. But 2011, I got a DUI in a company truck. Big problem on that. I've been on a bicycle. I remember in 2015, oh yeah, that was supposed to start off with my joke, so this cat walks into a bar. But 2015, I've been working, I've been fired, I've lost this. I got rehired by Culligan for the second time in 2013. I drank all the time. Anyway, my roommate who I still live with, she brought home this cat and he was sick, and I'm like, take it back, get rid of it. I'm not compassionate at this time in life. So she calls her friend, and it turns out it's Sarah, of course, the cat lady. She comes over, takes it to the vet, gets his medicine, gets his shots, and I tell her, I don't have any money for this. And she said, I didn't ask you how much money you had. I didn't tell you just that she shipped that out. I saw her about 4 days later. No, maybe it was actually about a month later. I'd gotten into a big fight with my roommate. I don't know what about. She did something stupid, I'm sure. So I didn't agree with what she had done. So I was riding by the 1600 Club, and I lived about 4 or 5 blocks from there. And if you're from our town, you're familiar. If you're not, probably doesn't matter. But I used to ride by there every day, going to work. And so I started parking and I asked her, well, what is this place? And she said, this is the 1600 Club. And I said, well, Helena, or what do they call that? Lano, that's AA. She said, well, this is AA. She invited me to a meeting. I was drunk enough, it sounded like a really good idea. The next day, all right, here we go, I'm fucking sober already. So. Anyway, the next day, she comes over at 5:30, she's got all this stuff, 12 and 12, big butt. And I went to work the next day, I told my friend, of course, we wake up the next morning, we're like, oh my God, what did I do? So I told my friend, I go, I screwed up last night, and he said, what'd you do? So I told this girl, I want to go to AA, I got to get out of this. So I did. I made sure I smelled like beer when she showed up. I told her I have beer left, I don't want to dump it out, I don't want to go to a meeting, blah, blah, blah. And she said, okay, no problem. She said, there's a meeting tomorrow, Saturday, 12 noon. I'll be there. 11:59 p.m. I took a 40-ounce of Mickey's and checked it. Did my ceremonial, not all dramatic. Goodbye. My friend shows up the next morning and he says, did you get out at meeting? And I said, absolutely. And he goes, cool, I got a 12-pack. Well, he had 8 left, but he said, how is it? It's like 10 in the morning. He's like, have a beer. And I said, no, I told that chick I'm going to go to AA. And he goes, wait till Monday. Nobody clicks on Saturday. That's stupid. And it made sense. It really did make sense. But I had the most profound thought and words. I told him, I said, if I don't go today and get sober, I don't think I ever will. And I ended up going to that meeting, and so far I haven't felt it necessary to leave. I have been sober. My sobriety date is April 18, 2015. I came into my first meeting. That's sort of pretty quick. I came into my first meeting, and I didn't care for it. They were playing Jenga, like life-size Jenga, and they're laughing and giggling. And I was looking for a maypole, like they're going to be dancing. And I remember Sarah told me, she said, we're having a barbecue at 2. You're coming back, right? I told her, I said, look, if I feel pressure, I said, I'll shut down and you'll never see me again. That would show her. I ended up coming back. I started getting into this sobriety thing. I came to a meeting. I took a 24-hour shit. And I always carry this when I speak. If you don't, you know, if you're new, pretty much everybody has one of these. I've been blessed with just the one. Doesn't make me any better, doesn't make my sobriety any stronger, doesn't make me any less of an alcoholic. But I'm blessed with that shit. I came in and I started going to meetings. And I remember it was like around day 24. They were talking about turning your will and your life over the care of God. And I was sharing, and I told this old lady, or, you know, she had like 40 years. I said, every day before, when I get off work, I flip a coin. I said, if it comes up heads, I go to a meeting. If it's tails, I'm going to stay home and get drunk. I go for 24 days, it's come up heads. And she goes, no, young man, that's not what we mean. Stop doing that. And, it turned out that I have a two-headed coin. And I did. I flipped it every day. And it's the stupidest thing because I could have chosen not to flip the coin. But I felt I had to have something more than me. I had to have some type of a committal because left up to me, I would have gone. I did start. I found a sponsor. I started getting steps. Sarah told me to be of service at a spaghetti feed. I had 42 days, you know, we took a picture under the cross. And, I started hearing people talking about, you know, like when I showed up, I couldn't look people in the eyes. I hated everything and everybody and everything about everybody. I heard somebody share the thing he hated the most was the truth about himself. And I could relate to that. I was riding a bicycle for 4 years. I lived in a 1 square mile radius. I drank every single day. It wasn't like, shit I drank, shit I drank. I just drank. It just, every single day. I hadn't been past Clark Avenue or Santa Maria Bridge. I lived in such an emptiness. And what sucks about getting sober, especially after 35 years of drinking, is all these things I suppressed, all these events, all the things I had done to other people started popping up. I started becoming aware of how much I couldn't stand me. I couldn't look people in the eyes. I believe the eyes are the window of the soul. And you could see every horrible thing about me if I looked you in the eye. You told me I could be rid of this. You told me we had a solution. You told me we have some steps. I'm like, let's do the one that I feel better. They said, no, there's a process you need to follow. You need to work these steps in order. I started working the steps. I came to meetings every day. I didn't really read the stuff. I didn't think this was going to work, to be honest. I didn't think there was a possibility that I could drink and do other things for 35 years and then stop one day and that just be it. So I'm telling you, if you've been drinking either for 35 years or less, it can happen. I got into the steps, I started working on 1 and 2, and I was powerless over alcohol, my life was becoming manageable. I asked my sponsor about the powerless over alcohol, and I said, what are you talking about? Are you talking about drinking, the effects, he said, all of that. I think the big book describes it on page 34, it talks about the baffling part of our alcoholism. It says you have an ability to leave it alone no matter how deep and aggressively you wish to do so, we cannot. And I fell into that category. I could not stop. I wanted to, I hoped I could. I couldn't. I kept going to the meetings, continued working steps. Remember, I took a 6-month shift, and then I got fired the next day for the second time from that job. What happened? Somebody had made a false report about something I had done, but I was guilty of it 6 times previously, so it was really easy to believe. I went after 9. I was a retaliatory. This girl told me I had anger issues. And I told her, you got no reason to talk the way your husband knocks you around at home. Apparently that's inappropriate. And my reasoning was, well, if she wouldn't have said this, I wouldn't have said this. I didn't just come and attack this poor girl. She started, and that was my mentality. They told me I can't control people, places, things. I can't control what you say or do. The only thing I can control is how I react. And not there yet. I am today, but I couldn't at that time. I got fired, and it was almost funny because they brought me in the office and they sat me down and here comes the HR lady and here comes 4 coworkers, big guys, and something was up and they told me we're going to have to let you go. And I was totally blown off. And I've been to a meeting like where we talk about praying for others. So when somebody was letting me go, I said, okay. I said, obviously God has other plans for me. It doesn't include working here. I wish you guys the best of luck. And I was totally calm and peaceful and relaxed. And it was scary. I never reacted that way. And I'm telling you, these people probably didn't sleep good for 4 or 5 days. They were expecting this big outburst. But alcoholics anonymous was taught me at that moment you know, cause and agitate or don't. You know, I remember people would invite me to go places, and I told them, well, I complained they never invited me, and then my sponsor told me I'm kind of a jerk. So then they invited me, and I told them no. because when I look back at it, I realized that if I started feeling awkward and uncomfortable, this is a 2 or 3 day motorcycle trip up to Ballinger Canyon. If I started feeling awkward and uncomfortable, I had no escape valve. I had no escape valve. I guess I didn't want to go. I didn't feel comfortable. I had nothing to bring to the table. It was all their toys. Just the whole deal. You know, I wanted to tell you, at 5 months, my dad did come out and visit my mom and dad, and I spent some time with them. Sarah brought me to a meeting, and I remember I told him we were going on a date, so I didn't want to break down an enemy, and she showed up, picked me up. We went to this meeting, and I told her, she goes, No, tell them I'm an alcoholic or a drug addict, you know. I'm like, wow, you know, anything but I'm on a date with you. That was my interpretation. So, anyway, my dad ended up saying, and this is my final chip on Earth. This is a 5-month chip my dad gave me last night. I saw him. He told me how proud he was, the whole family. It was pretty emotional, man. I was stoked. So then I moved forward, and I ended up, after I got fired, I got another job right after Thanksgiving. I went on that motorcycle trip. It was December 1st, and I started a new job. I was riding my bicycle off the skyway, and I'll never forget it. It was December 11th, Friday. My sister showed up at my house, and she told me my dad had passed away. And that one really hit me hard. I was so excited. I was, you know, job's done. I got a job and all this thing. When she told me my dad passed away, I remember sitting out in the backyard, and I had a bottle of Jack Daniels. And I didn't want to get buzzed. I wanted to just completely disconnect. And you know, it's like with the pickup and the doctor's opinion and everything, with the obsession and all that, and it talks about even essentially for the effect. The main reason I drank was to disconnect from me. So I called this guy Raymond. Raymond was the guy I forgot to mention when I first showed up my second day. He gave me his phone number. And he said, I'm Raymond. My sponsor thinks I should give you my phone number. And he had about 9 months, and I tore it up and threw it in the trash, and I told him, if I wanted your phone number, I would have asked you for it. Leave me alone. You know who I called that night my dad passed away? Raymond. His dad had passed away a month ago, and he was still sober. I remember how important it was that I saw Principle Before Personalities, that he was willing to help me, even though I wasn't the most friendly person. That he cared more about keeping me sober than how I treated him. And that was really attractive. So December 11th, some of you may know, there's a guy named William Griffith Wilson. Does that ring a bell? A lot of you may know him as Dr. Bill. Bill Wilson. His sobriety date I found out is December 11th, 1934. That was the same date my dad passed away. And this guy passed away January 24th, 1971. And he was 75 years old. My dad was 75 years old. And I thought that was kind of cool. So I remember I was going to work, and like I said, I was in tears. I was crying, emotional, I wanted it. I just wanted to give up. But I kept going. I went to work, and I rode my bicycle, and I put a motor on it. Anyway, the lunch pail got stuck in it, and between the tire, and it was pouring down rain, and I was crying. I was crying so hard that I started laughing. I just thought, oh my God. But I knew if I didn't show up to work, I knew where I was heading, man. I knew I'd go home. I'd be having to find a job. They told me, you know, people were making fun of me at work because I was missing teeth. I was a 50-year-old man riding a bicycle, $9 an hour, assembling job. And I remember people telling me, don't compete, don't compare, and don't retaliate. And that came into my head. I learned about acceptance, and I had to accept everything exactly the way it's supposed to be right now. What happens is if I start comparing to where you are, what you have, or where the things I used to have, or where I think I should be, I'm going to fall into self-pity, I'm going to fall into that self-destruction, and then the next day, I'm going to be wishing I had everything I just destroyed. I knew I had to keep going. And I did. I kept reading that acceptance thing, and where it said, acceptance is the answer to all my problems. When I'm disturbed, it's because I find some person, place, thing, situation, some fact in my life unacceptable to me, and I can find no serenity until I accept that person, place, thing, or situation as the exact way it's supposed to be at this moment. Nothing has to be, nothing happens in God's word by mistake. Until I could accept my alcohol, I could not stay sober. Until I could accept life, until my life turns, I could not be happy. I need to concentrate not so much as what needs to be changed in the world, but what needs to be changed in me and my attitude. And I had to apply that. I had to see that I was exactly where I was supposed to be. George Allen told me, he said, he broke it down for me simply. He said, if everything is exactly what it's supposed to be, he said, if it wasn't supposed to be like this, it wouldn't be like this. It would be like something else. I'm like, I can buy into that. I'm good. Okay. I got through my father's death, and this is the voice up here. I forgot the fourth step. Way back then, I did my first step, and I just say the truth about me, my past. Although nothing had changed about it, I had a different perception of it. I didn't hate the person I was. I started having that spiritual awakening where it talks about a profound alteration in my reaction to life. With the debt, with this, I started reacting differently. I didn't feel it necessary to disconnect. I knew if I did, that I would basically destroy any chance for a positive future. I got into service. I came up to the Mesa group. I've been going to the 1600 Club for about 16 months. Went up there, and you guys welcomed me, and I was more receptive. I got into service. I found out about this bonfire meeting, and they needed a good person. And I was like, cool, I got my Suburban now. Bonfire meeting. I remember when I showed up, it was pure ego. That's why I took it. I wanted to be the center of attention. I want to be the guy. People were praising me, and I was loving it. I was just sucking this up. Yes, thank you. And then I remember about after a year, I went to the restroom, and I looked back, and I saw the 40 or 50 people around the bonfire, and then I really got to see the meaning of, you know, this meeting. I got to see that I was able just to contribute, but I slowly learned about just humility. Johnny Odom, Robert, were great examples, and they told me the greatest title I can ever achieve in Alcoholics Anonymous is humble servant. And that was, you know, it was no longer about me. It was no longer, that's what I'm doing. Oh, they must be in my jacket. My nose. I don't exactly know everything to say. There you go. Oh, these don't make any sense. When I got here, I remember sharing, I guess to describe my drunk a lot, was pretty much every thought, motive, action revolved around the pursuit, consumption, effects, and consequences produced by drugs and alcohol, or alcohol and drugs. The consequential health of life that the use of alcohol had produced was far less or far more bearable than the internal hell emotional that I felt inside that I was using the alcohol to disconnect from. And that's when I was getting on that topic, was that's why I drank, to disconnect. Today, like I said, I've worked the steps. I did 4, I did 5, I've done 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. I don't have that utter rage. I don't have that hatred. I used to hate seeing people succeed, achieve. I was bitter, angry. And today, my life basically revolves around the pursuit, consumption, affection, blessings produced by Alcoholics Anonymous. To think that I could go from, where I was, which was, lonely, scared. I remember I wanted to fit in with people, but I had no social skills. Today I have like friends I never wanted. But that I needed, just what a blessing to not have my life consumed by that. To not want to hurt people, to not I love seeing people succeed. I love seeing people reach milestones. I love seeing people obtain things, get in relationships, marriages. I don't live in abundance today. I have 3 vehicles, which is great because when I got here I had no license, insurance, registration, nothing. But like one's a 1982 motorcycle, but one's a 93 Chevy Suburban, and one's a 2000 Honda. So they equal 95 years. And, they served me well. That bonfire got me that firewood commitment where I
met a large majority of people from the five cities area. Would I like to have, for Scott, would I like to have Scott's party? Absolutely. Would I like to have this guy's truck? Would I like to have your career? For sure, your paycheck. I'd like to have lots of things. But it's not necessary to fulfill me. It doesn't... I'm content with what I have today. I'm not trying to... I'm okay, you know? I'm okay with what I have, where I am, how I live my life. So to most people, my life really doesn't appear very attractive. It's menial at most, you know? But to alcoholics who can relate to coming in here empty, broken, no hope, the fact that I can even be an asset to the human race in even the smallest degree is great. I would love to say I've changed, but as far as I can see, I've been changed. The program of Alcoholics Anonymous has changed me by staying out of the way of powers within myself, by, you know, God staying out of his way. I've been changed. It's just, if you're new, I don't know how to keep you sober. I don't know how to give you the blindness. I don't know how to give you the honestness. I don't know how to keep you from drinking. All I can do is tell you what I did, you know, what I was like, what I did and how I am today. Just like absolutely forever grateful to the Rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I look back at, you know, I try not to forget where I come from. And I also know that I can be there tomorrow. But one thing with Alcoholics Anonymous has never changed and never will change is the effect produced when I take a drink. I suffer from a mental obsession that's not my craving. I can no longer drink successfully. And you know what? I've accepted my alcoholism. And until I can accept my alcoholism, I cannot stay sober. I'm okay with it. That's fine. I don't have to drink. I have other ways of dealing with life. I don't have to, you know, I'm happy, man. I'm happier than I've ever been. And the fact that God has taken me, broken, empty, hateful, and that I can, like I said, just, you know, my experience is my greatest asset in the world, working with a newcomer, right? I don't hate me, I don't hate you, and I'm just going to shut up at God. Thank you.
Let's give James another round of applause.